The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Diane Edelman for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Reader's Digest. Our first article is from the National Interest column, The Crypto Scam That Snared a Small Town. How Did a Successful Banker Gamble His Community's Money Away? By David Yaffe Bellany. Jim Tucker could hardly believe what he was hearing. It sounded like fiction, a nightmare too outlandish for an unassuming town like his. It was July 2023, and Tucker was hosting a meeting of the board of directors of Heartland Tri-State Bank, a community-owned business in a small Kansas town called Elkhart. Heartland was a beloved local institution and a source of family pride. Tucker served on the board with his elderly father, who had founded the bank 4 decades earlier. All the board members, the Tuckers and several other farmers and business people, had known one another for years. That evening, however, they were gathering to discuss what seemed, on its face, an epic betrayal. Over the past few weeks, the bank's longtime president, a popular local businessman named Sean Haynes, had ordered a series of unexplained wire transfers that drained tens of millions of dollars from the bank. Haynes had converted the funds into cryptocurrencies. Then the money had vanished. Tucker's first inkling that something was wrong came from a friend, an investor in the bank who was close to Haynes. A few days before the board meeting, he confided to Tucker that Haynes had messed up. A wire transfer had gone out, supposedly to help a struggling customer, and now the bank was $30 million in the hole. By the time the board members gathered, it was clear that Heartland was caught up in some sort of financial scam, a sophisticated grift that had delivered the bank's assets into the clutches of an overseas crypto crime network. At the meeting, Haynes seemed oddly nonchalant, exuding the air of an overconfident salesman. Tucker had heard that he'd spent the past week at an out-of-state leadership conference. "Guys, I'm sorry," Haynes told the board, "but we're going to get it fixed." Haynes promised that he could recover the money, by then a total of $47.1 million. All he needed was the board's approval to borrow another $18 million. With the help of some business contacts, he said, he would use those funds to recoup the many millions he had already lost. His banking career was probably finished, he acknowledged, but the deal came with a sweetener that would allow him to start over. "The people I'm working with have built in money for me," Haynes explained. Tucker, a 50-year-old farmer, had no special expertise in finance. He had grown up in Elkhart, graduated from Elkhart High School, and returned after college to work on his family's farm. He was accustomed to people deferring to Haynes, whom his father considered a brilliant executive. But then Haynes was telling the board that someone in Hong Kong had frozen millions in crypto holdings that he had acquired while working with a couple of internet acquaintances, a banker named Rob, who had good relationships in Washington, D.C., and a woman named Bella, with family in Australia. He didn't know much more about them, but he did trust the two. Haynes seemed hopeful that his pitch had worked. When the board reconvened the next morning, he showed up in shorts and flip-flops, put down his briefcase, and started passing out paperwork, laying out ways for the bank to borrow more money. But Jim Tucker had had enough. He slid the forms back to Haynes. "Sean, I don't even know who you are right now," Tucker said. "I don't believe anything you've said." Lodged in the state's southwestern corner, Elkhart is home to roughly 1,700 people, many of whom work in agriculture, tending to rows of crops that seem to stretch endlessly in every direction. "People come here with a dream," Tucker says, "and find out it's a lot of work." For decades, Heartland was a source of stability in a rapidly changing world. In 2016, Haynes testified at a banking hearing in the U.S. House of Representatives, describing the town as an old-fashioned community built on trust. Some mornings, he said, members of his bank staff woke up to find piles of cash sitting in their unlocked pickup trucks, informal loan payments from loyal customers who knew the money would end up in the right place. That is what it means to be a community rural banker, Haynes declared. Heartland was founded in 1985 after a group from Elkhart, including Jim Tucker's father, Bill Tucker, banded together with some outside investors. They wanted to create an alternative to another bank in the area, a business they felt had made it too difficult to secure loans. The new bank became a point of pride for Elkhart, even after it was taken over in the early 1990s by a holding company called Kansas Bank Corporation. Around that time, Haynes, who grew up in nearby Keyes, Oklahoma, started at the bank as a loan officer. He rose up the ranks and was eventually named president in 2008, earning acclaim for his fluency in both the language of finance and the farming vernacular of his neighbors. A part-time preacher at a local church, Haynes embodied a certain small-town ideal. He lived in a nice house with his wife and three daughters and volunteered at high school football games. But in 2011, the leaders of the Kansas Bank Corporation grew concerned about Haynes. They had discovered problems in his loan portfolio, borrowers who lacked sufficient collateral and financial paperwork that didn't seem to add up. Haynes was eventually fired. Regardless, local allies helped Haynes turn a career setback into a business opportunity. He assembled a group of local investors who started a bid to buy back the bank and restore control of the most important institution in Elkhart to people who actually live there. In 2012, Haynes returned as president of Heartland. The bank was controlled by a group of roughly 35 local investors, including Haynes and his wife, as well as Jim Tucker and his father. No one outside Elkhart would dictate the bank's future, and all the profits would flow back into the area. For years, under Haynes' leadership, Heartland generated a reliable dividend, money the bank's shareholders invested in their farms, saved for retirement, or spent on nursing home care for aging relatives. Elkhart's financial culture was the polar opposite of the crypto ethos that began to go mainstream around the time this new iteration of Heartland was founded. Early crypto proponents envisioned a fully automated form of exchange. No bankers, no middlemen, just lines of computer code whose techno-rationality would eliminate any need for interpersonal trust. As a career banker, Haynes was skeptical. He once told a colleague that anyone who used crypto must have something they're trying to hide. Yet in December 2022, after the woman using the name Bella approached him on social media, Haynes began buying cryptocurrencies himself. Bella claimed that her aunt ran a crypto firm in Australia, and she introduced Haynes to a website that seemed to be a crypto investment platform. Soon, she and Haynes were exchanging frequent messages on WhatsApp, usually multiple times a day. By the standards of Elkhart, Haynes was already a wealthy man, but this investment apparently required colossal sums. Within months, he had dipped into his daughter's college fund, spending $60,000 on digital currencies. Online scams are as old as the internet. But the rise of crypto has given con artists a valuable new tool, digital coins that can be transferred instantly without oversight from banks legally obligated to monitor transactions for malfeasance. In 2024, crypto fraud cost American investors an estimated $6.5 billion, according to the FBI. The scams are so common that law enforcement authorities have taken to calling them by a pithy name, pig butchering, a rough translation of an expression widely used in China, where these scams have proliferated in recent years. The scammer's victim is the pig, slowly fattened for slaughter. The scams typically begin with messages on LinkedIn, Facebook, or WhatsApp from an unknown phone number or someone posing as a romantic prospect. Sometimes the conversations lead to business introductions, a connection to a banker, or an asset manager with a slick headshot and a fictional resume. The target is offered an investment opportunity, often backed up by a fraudulent website masquerading as an actual crypto business or an app that displays fake profits on fake account statements. Eventually, the scams all end the same way. The money disappears. After draining his personal savings, Haynes began stealing from his local investment club, from his church, and finally, from the bank. Over a few weeks, he ordered a series of large wire transfers, telling his bewildered colleagues that he was helping a client. In May 2023, Haynes transferred $3 million from Heartland to an account at a company called Kraken, which offers trading in digital currencies. To buy more crypto, he directed Heartland to borrow about $21 million from a network of regional lenders and siphoned a similar amount using a credit line that the bank maintained with another institution. In June, Hayden sent $31 million of the embezzled funds to his Kraken account. As his lawyer would put it later, Haynes was the pig that was butchered. On July 5, 2023, not long before Heartland's board meeting, Haynes sent a text to a farmer named Brian Mitchell. He needed help with something. Mitchell didn't have a role at the bank, but he was used to fielding requests from friends in town. With a diamond stud in one ear, Mitchell stood out among the other farmers. He was one of the most successful people in Elkhart, a veteran businessman who owned a regional chain of movie theaters, including one a block from Heartland. When Mitchell walked into the bank that morning, he wasn't sure what to expect. Haynes was a longtime friend and neighbor. Their children had grown up across the street from each other. Maybe he wanted advice about a medical problem. But what Haynes actually wanted was $12 million, immediately. It was surreal, Mitchell recalls. Like, okay, am I in a loan office in Elkhart, Kansas? Or am I in a back alley in Chicago with a loan shark? Haynes told Mitchell a confusing story. Not long ago, Haynes explained, he started investing in cryptocurrencies with the help of some people he had met online. First, he and his partners deposited money on a reputable U.S. platform for buying and selling crypto. The profits were enormous, he said. He took out his phone to show Mitchell his account balance, which seemed to indicate that the investment was worth $40 million. But a problem arose after Haynes and his partners moved the funds to a Hong Kong trading platform that charged lower fees. The money had somehow gotten stuck, and only way to unfreeze it was to send more. As he sat in Haynes's glass-walled office, Mitchell wondered what his friend had gotten himself into. Mitchell was not interested in sending $12 million to a mysterious crypto operation in Hong Kong. Go there, hire an interpreter, and get a cashier's check, he told Haynes. If you think you've got $40 million in an account, go get it. But Haynes seemed to have stopped listening. He was staring past Mitchell into the bank lobby, where his staff was arriving to start the day. He barely reacted when Mitchell offered his verdict. Sean, I think you're in a scam. That day, Sean Haynes sent another $8 million to his crypto account. Troubled, Mitchell alerted some contacts at Heartland, and within weeks, the board was holding its crisis meeting, demanding an explanation. By the end of July, the Kansas banking regulator was examining Heartland's accounts, and a procession of state and federal agencies descended on Elkhart. Heartland was insolvent. On July 28, 2023, Cargo vans and black SUVs surrounded the bank building on Morton Street. Staff members gathered in the lobby, where the Kansas banking commissioner told them that Heartland would shut down. On Monday, he said, it would reopen with a new owner, a company called Dream First Bank, based a couple of counties over. None of the bank's customers would lose their deposits. Those federally insured accounts would move over to Dream First Bank. But shares in the bank's holding company were now worthless, erasing years of investment gains. Many of the shareholders lost the bulk of their savings, retirement nest eggs, and emergency funds. The day of the closure, Jim and Bill Tucker joined the staff in the bank lobby. An hour earlier, Jim Tucker had helped his father find the signature line on the government paperwork that dissolved the business their family had started in 1985. "It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do," he says. "We still don't understand why. We didn't understand what happened." The Tuckers lost $1.4 million worth of shares, and with them, a source of wealth that Jim Tucker had hoped to pass on to his children. The failure of Heartland thrust Elkhart into a state of fear and confusion. Nobody could quite believe what had happened. But everyone seemed to agree that the money was gone. Wire transfers out of the bank had spiderwebbed into an array of untraceable crypto wallets, a federal investigator explained in court last year. There is no indication that anyone knows where it is at this point or how to access it, the investigator added. Still, a few clues emerged on the blockchain, a public ledger of crypto transactions. Many crypto scammers are based in Southeast Asia, where organized crime rings run pig butchering operations. At least some of the money that Haynes stole may have ended up in the hands of an organization that targeted other Americans. In 2023, the scammers who approached Haynes appeared to have orchestrated a similar plot that ensnared a wealthy Minnesotan, according to the crypto forensics firm Chain Analysis, which analyzed the Heartland case. The man was approached on LinkedIn by a woman who urged him to invest in crypto and to leave his wife for her. He lost more than $9 million. In May 2024, Sean Haynes pleaded guilty to a federal charge of embezzlement by a bank officer, a felony that carries a maximum sentence of 30 years in prison. In the Wichita courtroom, Haynes offered his only public reflection on the bank collapse. "I'm sorry," he told Judge John W. Brooms, who was overseeing the case. Until the very end, he explained, he thought he was involved in a legitimate business deal. In January 2024, he said, he made a futile attempt to recoup the lost money, flying to Perth, Australia, where some of his non-existent business partners had supposedly been based. He was in touch with them until the moment he landed at the airport, but no bailout materialized. It was only then, months after the bank shuttered, that he accepted he had been tricked. "I'll forever struggle understanding how I was duped," Haynes told the court. Judge Broom sentenced Haynes to 24 years and 5 months in prison, a punishment even greater than federal prosecutors had requested. A chorus of quiet yeses echoed from the shareholders. Haynes's shoulders slumped. As two U.S. marshals approached him, he undid his tie, slipped off his suit jacket, and emptied his pockets. Behind him, the shareholders went quiet. Haynes's sister and one of his daughters clung to each other, their sobs breaking the silence. Haynes looked at them quickly before the marshals handcuffed him and led him out of the room. One day last October, Jim Tucker got a call from an investigator at the FBI. It was good news. Federal officials had recovered $8 million of the stolen funds. It was a small fraction of what Haynes had stolen, but it would be enough to reimburse the shareholders for nearly all the money they had invested in the bank. The jubilation Tucker might have expected to feel was tempered by sadness. His father had been in and out of the hospital, and a doctor warned that he had only days left to live. That night, he went to his father's hospital room and shared what he had heard. Bill Tucker blinked a few times and then said, "Oh, my." He died a week later. In Elkhart, Jim Tucker and the other shareholders are still searching for answers. For decades, they felt bound to their neighbors by ties of family and friendship, ties that turned out to be weaker than they supposed. And then their lives were upended by a chain of connections they had never imagined, invisible links to villains on the other side of the world. After the bank collapsed, Jim Tucker started therapy, hoping he could reach a sense of equilibrium. For now, though, he relishes the idea that Haynes will suffer in prison, enduring sleepless nights and days filled with misery. The demise of Heartland is still a source of pain. The last 15, 16 months of my dad's life, this was what was on his mind, he says. He lived a good life. He was a good person. And then that's what he goes out with? Elkhart was once just a little farming town in the middle of nowhere, cut off from everything but the land itself. It was a place whose isolation was part of its charm, where neighbors prayed together and relied on each other. Now, every time Jim Tucker drives past the bank, he's reminded of a globe-spanning betrayal. The trust that was broken, he says, his voice trailing off. That one stings. That was The Crypto Scam That Snared a Small Town by David Yaffe Bellamy. And now a second shorter article, A Navy SEAL's Secrets to a Lasting Marriage. I trained to avoid friendly fire. That helped at home, too, by Jason Redman. In July 1998, I was a young, single Navy SEAL, traveling the world, jumping out of airplanes, shooting guns, and training with like-minded, highly capable young men. I decided to host a barbecue, and I invited platoon mates and friends from across SEAL teams. One of my platoon members said he looked forward to coming. I asked him if his wife was joining. He looked sheepish, paused, and said, "No, I don't think so. Things are not going so well." A few months later, they were divorced. And so began a trend that I saw over my 21-year career. The divorce rate among Navy SEALs is extraordinarily high, more than 90%. A year later, I met Erica. I started our relationship by lying to her. SEALs often create cover stories about their identities. Sometimes it's for security reasons, but we have found that telling someone you just met that you were a SEAL often creates more problems than opportunities. As Eric and I dated, I maintained the lie. After almost a month, my training was ending, and I realized I was falling for this amazing person. So I told her the truth. I was a Navy SEAL. I told her I intended to do at least 20 years of service. I told her the job was difficult and dangerous. I would be gone, on average, 280 days a year. And frequently, she would be coming home alone, raising the children, fixing things, and celebrating holidays without me. She said she didn't care. We were in it together. A year and a half later, as we entered our marriage, we laid out ground rules. We had come from bad relationships and from divorced families. We would not divorce. Little did I know that these ideas would become the foundation of our marriage. They helped us navigate the hardest adversity of our relationship. In 2007, my SEAL team and I were caught in a deadly ambush in the Iraqi desert. I took 7 machine gun rounds to my body armor, weapon, helmet, and arm. Desperate to get out of the line of fire, I stood up and took a round to the face, which blew out my cheekbone, damaged my eye muscles, broke most of my nose and jaw. As I lay there bleeding out, I begged God for one more day with my wife and family. I could see Erica's smile in my mind, and I wanted another birthday with her, another Christmas. When I awoke in the ICU at the Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, several days later, bandages covering most of my face, tubes running out of every part of my body, I had a new fear. Would my wife, my long-haired admiral who had stuck by me through the ups and downs of a wartime military career, recoil at the sight of me? We had watched so many marriages fail. She pushed through my hospital room door, grabbed my good hand, and leaned in to kiss me. "We're going to get through this together," she said. Over our 24-year marriage, my battlefield wounds were probably the most devastating impact we sustained. But there were many other tests. We lost friends and teammates to training and war. We raised 3 wonderful kids and endured through special operations and war. We navigated sickness, financial challenges, and transitioning out of the military. We confronted PTSD as I lost myself in the bottom of a bottle and pushed everyone away. SEALs are trained to accomplish the mission above all, above self, to never leave anyone behind. Erica and I ran our marriage like a mission, a no-fail mission with rules of engagement, like no ultimatums. We never make demands that shut down discussion or threaten our relationship. We don't throw around words like divorce or say things like, "Do this or I'm out." We refuse to engage in abusive conduct, hurtful labels, or personal attacks. In SEAL teams and combat missions, we have to verify that every command or communication is received by the right party. To be healthy, a relationship or marriage needs both parties to signal that they're listening, whether it's formal active listening technique or a simple repeat back and Roger. This strategy ensures both partners feel heard and understood, even during disagreements. I have spent countless hours in training and combat, studying the enemy and their tactics, and learning how to destroy their capabilities. But SEALs also train how to avoid attacking each other. A battle zone can be chaotic, with only seconds to determine if the weapon facing you is friendly or hostile. Some of the most devastating losses in war come from friendly fire incidents in which miscommunication or mistakes led to death. In a marriage conflict, when you make your spouse the enemy, you've lost. We've run out of time for today's episode. I'm Diane Edelman, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Reader's Digest is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.